Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I am your host, Tracy Thomas. We are back this week with executive editor at Sunset Magazine, Hugh Garvey. Hugh joins us for our book club discussion of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat. That's right, we're taking on our first ever cookbook. There are no spoilers today. Here is your weekly reminder. In the show notes, there is a link. That link will take you to all the books discussed today, as well as the social media accounts for The Stacks and our guests. Plus, if you shop through the links on Amazon, you're helping to keep The Stacks free. If you're in need of a book recommendation, send us an email on askingthestacks@gmail.com. Myself and my guest will read it on air and give you a personalized book recommendation. So email askingthestacks@gmail.com with your name, what you're looking for, and maybe a few titles you've loved or hated. If you like The Stacks and want to support the work we're doing, here are a few easy ways you can help. First of all, you can join us on Patreon. You earn perks like our virtual book club and get to connect with other listeners of this podcast. Plus, you get to rest easy knowing your contribution helps to make this show possible. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to be a part of this fantastic community. Another way to support the show is support our sponsors like Audible. They're your go-to destination for all things audiobooks. Plus, if you listen to this show, you get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So sign up at audibletrial.com/thestacks. The last thing is the easiest. Just subscribe to The Stacks. Leave us a rating and a review. It's super helpful and it's super easy. So please, please, please take a moment to do that. And of course, we always invite you to tell someone you know about the show. Okay, now it's time for my conversation with Hugh Garvey about Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. All right, you guys, we are back again today with Hugh Garvey. Hugh is a food and lifestyle writer. He works at Sunset Magazine as an executive editor. Hugh, welcome back to The Stacks.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yay. Okay, today I'm so excited. I've been waiting for this episode for a while. We're talking about Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat. And I should say the illustrations are by Wendy McNaughton because the illustrations are a huge part of this book and I want to make sure she gets her props. It's a cookbook with a lot of not recipes, which is kind of amazing. So we always start in the same place. What do you think? What did you think of the book?
I mean, I love it. It's it is in some ways the perfect cookbook. Like I've in the past owned some 500 cookbooks, which I recently winnowed down to, I don't know, maybe 80 or so. And wow, this is one of the books that will forever remain in the shortlist and would even, I think, go into the top 10. And
yeah,
it's like, you know, I mean, I look at this book from the lens of a, you know, of a food editor and writer. And, you know, I mean, I worked at, you know, Bon Appetit for 9 years and I've written two cookbooks. And the funny thing is that we've always said this at every magazine that I've worked at in which we worked with food, is basically it's like, you know, the main thing we wish we could just tell people like, and so much about food that they would never need a recipe again. Mm. Right. And I don't think we actually would mean that, but right,
she bumps up right against that
recipes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so I
I think this is, I'm going to say this not trying to be too over the top. I think this is one of the most beautiful books I've ever owned. As far as aesthetically, it's so beautiful. I love her tone. I love her approach. She's clearly smart. She clearly knows what she's doing, but she's not super pretentious, even though she's telling you about her time at Chez Panisse, which is like so pretentious, right? For a chef, normally you'd be like, get out of here, Alice Waters wannabe. But she has a sense of humor about it, and it just strikes the right tone. I felt so inspired reading the book. I like to cook, but there are so many things that she talks about in this book that I've been scared to try, like braises or ragouts, where I'm like, I don't know. I love to eat them at a restaurant, but I never try it at home. And there's a part where she says, next time you cook a duck, just render the fat. And I'm like, I am going to cook a duck. I'm going to find a place to get a duck and I'm going to try, because she really, I felt like she believed that I could do it. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I could do it.
It's so great. Yeah. This is a book that I would give to anyone and will give to everyone that I know as we approach the holidays as a gift who loves to cook, because it really is, it is empowering is, you know, essentially what it is. And it's not so much like even like, you know, I want to say, yeah, she unlocks the secrets of why things work, and she does, but it doesn't feel as kind of strident as unlocking. She just makes it sound fun and natural,
and it doesn't feel cheap. Like this is the secret to cooking.
Yeah,
like it feels really. You read it and you think, okay, I could do that. Mm-hmm. I understand what too salty is. Mm-hmm. I understand what not salty enough is. I understand, and she leaves a lot of room for mistakes too, which I think, for my personality type, as a very type A rule follower recipe, I feel like I'm glued to a recipe when I cook normally. Even if it's something that I know how to cook and I've been cooking for years, I still pull out the recipe and I 6 tablespoons of, you know, basil. Like, does it really need to be 6 tablespoons? No, like, I'm being crazy.
Yeah. And she is, I mean, I think it's the... What it really is it is beautiful. Like, I can't overstate how lovely the illustrations are.
I know.
I mean, they're just like, and I think the illustrations are good because they're really the things that you're going to remember. Mm-hmm. Like, cause like when you flip back and you get to the actual recipes, they're all going to function. But like, before, like, 80% of the book, as you said, is not recipes.
Yeah.
And then finally toward the end, there are some recipes. But up to that point, you've been kind of, your brain has been sort of scrambled and opened up to just all of the science.
Right.
All of the possibilities of how these essential components, these super categories of cooking work. I mean, I guess we should probably...
It all down.
Yeah.
We'll backtrack a second.
Yeah, because we love it, clearly.
Because we're in love, yeah. So the book is called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Each of those words, salt, fat, acid, and heat, are the 4 components to cooking that Samin basically says, if you can master these and understand how these work, you can cook everything and anything. I will say the one exception she gives about recipes is you need to hold tight to baking recipes, is what she says. And that makes sense because they're very precise. But as far as cooking, have fun. The first one is salt. Salt is about flavoring food. So she talks about, you know, putting enough salt in the water when you boil pasta. She talks about the different kinds of salt. So salt can obviously come from salt, but it can come from cheese. It can come from animal fat. It can come from all sorts of things. So it's about, she basically explains why each thing is important. And then she talks about where you can find these things. She gives you examples of how to layer. So I think in the salt chapter, it's about making mayonnaise is the layering. So it's about the different kinds of salt that are in, or Caesar dressing. That's what it is. Then the next one is fat. And fat is super interesting because fat is a flavor builder. When you think about olive oil, but it also is a medium for cooking heat. So she talks about the different kinds of fat you can use and the temperatures. And she talks about using fat for finishing things. Again, it can be an oil, it can be butter. And she really gets into the science on that one. Acid is a flavor enhancer builder. Lemon juice. I mean, she talks about all the things that are acidic, including milk, which my husband was like, no, it's not. I was like, turns out milk is acid. He was like, well, then what's not acid? I was like, alkaline water, baking soda. That's all that she has in the picture in the book. So that's all I know. But acid is a way to enhance flavor, to cut flavor, to build flavor, to manage flavor. And then the last one is heat, which is the way that you cook your food. So she talks about the different, you know, she talks about boiling. She talks about simmering. She talks about grilling. She talks about the different ways you can saute and how the heat works and all of that stuff. And so those are the main components of the book. And that takes up the first 200 pages of the book, which is so fantastic. It's really compelling reading.
Well, yeah. And I think that really it's as I... You know, when you say all of that together, it sounds overwhelming, you know, but it's, the funny thing is, and the way she lays it out is it's not, because she's a character in this with you. And when you mentioned her experience at Chez Panisse, which could be insufferably pretentious.
Right.
And, you know, I'm like, again, like it, that is like at surface, you know, I don't want to hear about your experience
right.
of learning
I don't
how
care.
To cook at Chez Panisse, because you know, but like in the end, she's self-deprecating. She admits her ignorance. She shows when there are happy accidents, and you kind of feel like you're in there with the kitchen with her, but she's this sort of super student. Like she is like, she is a student and there and at heart, and therefore an amazing teacher, because she is, there's a sense of authority and wonder at every turn.
Oh my God, you're so right.
And she's just like, you're like, like, believe me, I've been bossed to by so many quote unquote chefs. And while she is a chef, she's a cook. Like she has the heart of a cook, but the mind of a chef.
Yeah.
And you know, and she talks about her, you know, growing up as a kid and this, you know, the salty taste of the sea, and how some people will say, like, oh, you need to salt your pasta water so it tastes like the sea. And she says, it should taste like your memory of the sea, because you don't actually want it to be 38%, you know, whatever. Right. And so she undoes these sort of bossy pronouncements. And then, like, that's a very poetic instruction. Like, it should taste like your memory of the sea.
Right.
Not what the sea really is.
Right.
And that's not a recipe. Like, that in the end is not a measurement.
Right.
It's not a pH level.
It's like not even that helpful.
Right.
If you're trying to tell someone else how much salt to put in. But it works.
Yeah, but it works.
Because everyone has that memory.
And so I think that's sort of like that ease and relatability and the conversational yet fully authoritative way she conveys all of this is just fantastic. And I love it. And you know, I think a lot of people might have seen the Netflix series, which I'm not sure if you watched.
I watched one episode yesterday. Uh-huh. I watched the fat episode.
Yes.
It's very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just watched the one. She goes to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
She makes a bunch of stuff. She makes a focaccia that just looks like, I need to make that immediately.
Yeah.
And she speaks Italian in it, which you're just like, of course you speak Italian fluently. So casual.
And she is, you see that approachability when you finally see that, you see the show, you see that she is self-deprecating. She's just this passionate eater who will just like, this is really in the end, even though it could be scientific, in the end, it's just about this like wordless, emotional, sensory experience. So it doesn't feel like learning, but it feels like liberation.
Yeah. Well, I'll push back a little bit, because some of it felt like learning for me, and I definitely struggled with some of the science. I'm super bad at science, super bad at science. And there were parts that I had to reread, especially in the heat section and the fat section.
Okay.
And I would be like, I don't understand what she's saying. I understood what the result was. Mm-hmm. Like, she would talk about rendering the fat on a piece of steak, like making sure that you seal in on all the sides, like turning it. Mm-hmm. But she had words for that had to do with reactions and things.
The Maillard reaction.
Yeah, I was like, I don't get this. Or there was a section on diffusion and osmosis. And
I had to read some of that.
Twice. Yeah. One of my dear friends from high school, as I say that I'm terrible at science, I did take AP biology in high school, which is like my one claim to fame of being a smart person. And I struggled so much with that in high school. I was on the phone with my dear friend who's now a doctor. So he was good at science. And he goes, honestly, Tracy, it's just, think of it as you pee in the toilet and then the water turns yellow. And so that's the only way that I understand diffusion now, even though that's not exactly it. But because, like, that's how my brain works. It has to be really broken down. So some of the science stuff for me felt too learning. But I think that that is just that I was a little confused. And some of it probably is also just I think that I'm bad at science. So when science comes up, I freak out, which is like a 7-year-old, you know, like, I'm like, I can't do it.
No, you know, that's fair. That's fair. there's some focus required.
Yeah. You have to pay attention. Mm-hmm. Like she's giving you a lot of information, but you can't just, you have to actually consume it and pay attention to what she's saying.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's good. Learning is good. Like one of the main notes I took down is I learned a ton in reading this book. Mm-hmm. Like, things like that. But one of the things that sticks out that I may hopefully will never forget as long as I live was about freezer burn.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about how what freezer burn is when the water inside your food, the cells, they burst and that water escapes. And so that's what's the water that has frozen in your plastic bag or in your wrapping or on your food. And I thought, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I understand life now.
Well, the thing is, she demystifies all of these sort of things that we almost, you know, in our, you know, understandable ignorance, because we can't comprehend everything at the molecular level.
Certainly.
She just realized, you know, you really realize that, like, these are not mysteries. This is intimidation. This is not magic. This is logical. And if you would like the answer, what I love about this is, like, if you would like the answer, you can have it, and it's here. Like, you don't, like, again, like, in my, you know, as I told you before, like, I'm a kind of a snacker of a reader, you know, and like, and I think that, like, if you are feeling a little like, I would approach this book, if you want to, like, treat it like, an education or like a curriculum, you absolutely should read it start to finish.
Yeah. But she says that too.
Yes. And that's really what she recommends.
Yeah.
But I would also say that, like, if you are a snacking reader, like I am, who doesn't finish everything. Yeah. And, like, honestly, I will return to this book for refresher courses on things. Like, I don't think that anyone should ever feel like you've read this and you're done. Like, you should, it is a textbook.
There's ton of information.
Yeah. And it's like, if you are going to be like, let's say you haven't braised between winters. Right.
Right.
And like next fall or winter, like I probably will return to the braising section and just try to get a little deeper knowledge of what's going on.
Right.
You know, when I go slow and low on something.
Right. Do you have someone who is around food a lot and cooks a lot and all that? Do you have food anxiety? Like, do you have fear of cooking certain things or certain foods that you won't try or types of cuisine? Or is that more like a layman cook?
No. I mean, I have a little, I mean, I have anxiety around baking because I'm so, like, because I am resistant to the guardrails and the precision.
We're opposite here. Obviously.
So I'm like, and that's not to say that I won't get into baking at some point in my life. But I do, I love the freedom to not do something the way, like once you start a baking recipe, you have to do it the way they say, right?
That's right.
And that is mostly true. And I will say that there's actually a Chad Robertson, I think, in the Tartine Baking book says that's actually not true. He's like, people are very strict about, I think even in Chez Panisse Baking, they say, people say it's scientific, it is, but then you can also improvise out the wazoo if you know.
You know what you're doing.
Like, you know, like a jam is a jam, but like be aware of the acidity levels, but like you can still play within it. Like it's not.
Right. You know, well, you can improvise with like a pie filling. like how you season your apples.
You go.
But like you can't go nuts on the crust.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
You got to be strict on the crust.
No, you're right. Okay, so so that's why I don't. Yeah, so I do clearly have anxiety about baking.
Okay.
Because when you say that, I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to try that.
Yeah. I used to have anxiety about pie crust. And then I found a pie crust recipe I loved from Smitten Kitchen. And it's great. And now that's what I use anytime I do anything. I'll use it. I don't really like to make pie. I prefer a galette because it's so much easier.
Yeah.
But that's what I use. But I have so much food cooking anxiety around meat and like the right kind of meat and the cut of meat, which is why I love a braised. Whatever. I love a ragu, but I never make it because I'm scared. I'm scared I'm going to not get the right amount, or like I'm not going to know how to cut the fat off, or that I just have so much like around it.
Yeah.
So this book, I took a note. I was like, okay, braises on this page. And what she does is she tells you, okay, this is this kind of meat. This is how you do it with this kind of meat. This is how long you need to cook it with this kind of meat. Like, she really breaks it down, but she, again, still says there's no right answer. It almost feels like when she wrote this book, she really wanted to write the first 200 pages and she didn't really want to write the recipe part.
Yeah.
And her publisher was like, well, you can't make a cookbook without recipes.
You know, I think you might be right there.
Because it feels like she doesn't want to write recipes.
You know, I the heart of the book really is the first, like the thrilling part is the first 200 pages.
Yeah.
And the other part's just like, okay, so like, you know.
And there's a lot of information in the other half. Like there's lots of paragraphs before the recipes or section, whatever. But it felt like that first 200 pages was her baby. And then her and her editor fought for 2 weeks and she was like, fine, this is how you make whipped cream. This is how you like, you know, like that she was like, okay.
Because I think there absolutely are better books and better recipes.
Sure.
Than like. The first half, there is nothing better than what she did in the first half.
Right.
There's a lot that's better than the second half.
Right.
And like, I would say like, I'm inspired by the first half. And like, I think there's enough, the recipes in the back are fine, but it's just like, what do I really want to make out of here? Like, I'm actually, I don't know, like I've made, I don't know, the pasta, like the bolognese pasta and Marcella Hazan's Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking is probably better than hers and is more interesting to read and learn from, you know. But Marcella can't set up the broad view of every super component of cooking the way that Samin has.
Samin's recipes feel like the very, very basics. Like she has a section on dressing and it's like every vinaigrette you've ever heard of. And it's basically the exact same thing. She just changes two things. And she also has, she'll have a recipe. Let's see. Let me pull up one. Whoops. She'll have a recipe for, just going to go to a random one when I find it. Okay. She'll have a recipe for light and flaky buttermilk biscuits. And she goes through all of the ingredients and what she learned about how to do it. And then afterward, she says variations. For shortcake, instead of X, Y, and Z, add sugar. For fruit cobbler, instead of this, do that. Mm-hmm. And she gives you another two recipes kind of just off the cuff because she really is not interested in the recipe part, which I appreciate because it makes, for someone like me who has food anxiety and has a baker's heart, it feels like, okay, it's not that big of a deal if I mess this up. Whereas, and that's a bad example because that is baking. But for me, I'm like, okay, I can just dive into this salad dressing. And if I fuck it up, I fuck it up and I throw it away. And if not, like, great, I found this new dressing. And so I think that that freedom that she gives her, an empowerment, like you said, that she gives her at-home cooks is invaluable. Because cooking can be scary.
You know, it can be scary. And like, I'm trying to think, like, I'm scared by stepping into cuisines that I'm not deeply familiar with because I don't want to be the novice at like how to make like dashi, you know, Japanese dashi that like tastes the way it should. Like I was like, I have no idea. Like I've had good dashi before, but like I don't have 20 years of experience cooking like Japanese broths the way I do 20 years of experience cooking Italian sauces, you know, Italian tomato sauce. So and it took me a long time to be able to improvise like a bolognese. It took me, it took me 20 years to be good at that. Right.
And you don't want to eat you don't want to spend time cooking a food that's not going to taste good.
Exactly. So like I'm scared to like, I've never made like dashi. And like, even though like, cause it seems to me like it's super intimidating. And like, I don't know, like I think I would have to cook dashi like 5 times to get it right. And I do have to say that like, with all of this knowledge, you still have to cook over and over and over again.
She says that.
Yeah, right.
She says, like, do these recipes a few times. Once you feel good, then you can start improvising, mm-hmm. which is why I think the recipes aren't particularly inspired either. Mm-hmm. She really just wants to get you up and running.
Exactly.
You know, she's like, okay, what's the simplest, most delicious way I can make, you know, this slow-cooked salmon? Once you get it, once you get the hang of it, you get what it's supposed to look like and feel like, then I've given you the tools to make it mm-hmm. bang, bang, outstanding.
Like, yeah, in some ways, it's like she's – the funny thing is if you've ever looked at a recipe at a restaurant from mm-hmm. – I don't know if you've ever seen like an industrial recipe from like – not even industrial, but just like what a recipe – how cooks what they're instructed to. Like let's say you were hired to be like a sous chef at, you know, I don't know, Austria Mozza, and they give you the recipe. The recipe would be very short and it would assume that you knew all of the first half of this book, right? And so like, you know, it's just like braise, you know, sear and braise off 20 pounds of lamb shanks.
Right.
You would freak out, right? But like, unless you'd done it 20 times, read this book, knew these principles and through practice had arrived at the right way of doing it.
Right.
And you might not even, like if you're a professional cook, you might not even be able to put it into like words.
It's what
just,
you do.
Yeah, it's just like assumed knowledge through repetition.
Right.
And you wouldn't be able to explain it the way she does, but she sets you up to then understand. So maybe you don't have to do it 20 times. You can do it 3, like she says.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like, so they really are like professional recipes are almost like very just short bullet points with mm-hmm. They're not many full sentences, right?
Right.
They're not sometimes there'll be some little insertion of something that the chef thinks is crucial to the success of the dish, but it's a lot of these fundamentals that she gets into.
Well, that's why so many cookbooks are not intuitive for at-home chef or mm-hmm. at-home cooks, because a chef has written it and it maybe hasn't been tested right, mm-hmm. or it's mm-hmm. been tested by people who get it also. Mm-hmm. And it's like sometimes I'll be cooking a recipe and be like, I don't understand how I got from X to Z. Like, mm-hmm. where is Y?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happens a lot with like important chefs.
Yeah,
you know, they're like, ugh, if you don't know how to do this already, which for me is immediate panic.
Yeah.
I failed. I don't know how to get the fish out of the pan mm-hmm. onto the lettuce.
Yeah.
I need someone to tell me what to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So when people are listening to this episode, it's the week before Thanksgiving, maybe 2 weeks before Thanksgiving. It's close to Thanksgiving. What do you say to people preparing for major cooking?
What would I say?
Yeah.
Oh,
because like now I'm going to cook a full Thanksgiving dinner because I'm inspired by this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you say? Do you do it? Do you do Thanksgiving?
I have. Mm-hmm. I don't always. Okay. I'm not like the last Thanksgiving we did. We had carnitas. We like did a whole, you know, so, you know, we got a pork shoulder and braised that.
Okay.
And I got to say, like, that's, you know, it's. I would say if you're going to do the traditional stuff, which it can be good, it's, again, not my favorite.
It's usually disgusting.
Menu.
We call it baby food. It's like a lot of baby food.
Yes.
It's like yams and wilted vegetables.
Well, are you going to do the traditional?
I probably will.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like tradition.
Okay.
But I mix it up. I do a bird.
Mm-hmm.
I brine a bird, like real bird.
But now you're going to head into brining with a much more
understanding of how it works, because I didn't know how it worked. I just put the ingredients in exactly like they told me. And then I'll throw in, like, I like a savory sweet potato, not mm-hmm. a marshmallow sweet potato.
Agreed.
So I do like a bacon sage one. Mm. Delish.
Sounds great.
And I make a mac and cheese that is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I make a great mac and cheese. My two favorite ingredients, noodles and cheese. But yeah, I don't know if you have like good advice for people.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's like you don't have to make like 5 side dishes.
No.
Like, you know, it's honestly, it's like because everyone always overeats and you don't – if there are 5 side dishes, like you see those plates where it's just like ridiculous. It's like, you know
– yeah.
Food is falling over the edge because you
and it's all like one color.
Yeah, right. I think that if you are going to do a bird, absolutely play with the brine, you know, and I'm not sure if you're going to brine it or if you're going to like do the dry salt rub, like a salt rub.
The wet one. Mm-hmm, where you like put in a big bag with like liquid.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I think that I'm, I would just make sure you just kill it with the turkey and also, learn how to carve it. Mm. Like there's a very important carving technique.
How can I learn how to carve it? Where do I go? Who will tell me that?
I can't remember. There was a book. Did I learn it from a book or a video? I can't remember.
It's okay.
Yeah, but it's not like the side slice. It's not where you're going.
Take like cut off the whole breast and then cut it into chunks.
That's the way to go.
Okay. That's what I do with my roast chicken too.
Yes, exactly.
Because
it's
juicier.
Right. And and then everyone gets a little skin on the outside. Yeah. And
Though I don't eat the breast, I only eat dark meat.
Okay. Yeah, that's
because it's the good part.
Exactly.
It's Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Are you on a diet? Do you need to be eating dry chicken breast or turkey breast?
I know. But the funny thing is, a good roast chicken's better than a good turkey any day.
Chicken is far superior to turkey.
Yes.
That's why we only eat turkey like once a year.
Absolutely.
I mean, except like deli
sandwiches.
Meat.
Yeah.
But I don't like a turkey sandwich.
I used to. I haven't had a turkey sandwich forever.
If I'm gonna have a sandwich, I'm gonna go salami maybe or roast beef,
right.
Something fattier, juicier. Yes.
Now, do you feel like you understand? Do you feel like this? That the book synthesized the balance of all of those things in your mind? Do you feel like in the end, while it broke it down into these four building blocks.
Yeah.
And do you feel like in the end you could become a better improviser using all of those things?
I do think so.
Okay.
Because I think that I understand the why a little bit more. Like, I understand why it's important to salt your meat early. Mm-hmm. I don't think that I understood how salt worked with protein enough, which I still probably don't understand it fully, but I didn't understand it enough to understand why that was important. But now I'm thinking, okay, next time I roast a chicken, I'm going to make sure that I salt it the day before. Or, okay, if this doesn't taste right, these are my options. And I think the fixing of the recipe is where normally I would just be like, something's not right, it's gross.
Yes.
Instead of being like, oh, it just needs more lemon juice.
Okay. So you comprehend that. Do you feel like you could improvise a salad? Could you invent a salad? Like if I just said, hey.
A salad dressing or
the entire
salad?
Like if you should go to Whole Foods right now and you need to create a salad using the principles in this book and talk me through every part of the salad that you learned. From how does what you learned in the book play out in this salad? Would you be able to?
I think so.
What you learned in a sort of show and tell.
I think so, but here's where I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I've eaten many salads in my life that have been delicious, so I feel that I would be influenced by those things.
Okay, but aren't they one and the same? I mean,
sure.
So you know those things,
right.
And now you know why they. So you're influenced by those salads,
right?
You now have the knowledge,
right,
of why how all of the components
work together,
come together. Do you feel like you could now create?
Yes,
salads.
I could create a salad.
Okay,
But that doesn't involve heat, which I feel like might be where I get thrown off. Do you know what I mean? Like I had a salad at Erewhon yesterday. It was delicious. Mm-hmm. And I put all my components and I shook it up and it was good.
Okay.
I think I could improvise some things. Mm-hmm. I think I could improvise like a pasta sauce.
All
I think I could do that.
Okay.
Because I feel comfortable with pasta. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I could improvise a braise because I don't do that yet. Mm-hmm. But I think like if it was something that I kind of do normally, I could improvise.
Okay. So with, I don't know why I'm stuck on the salad thing. I think you actually could.
I mean, I could heat a salad if I needed to.
Well, you could heat a component of the salad.
Yeah, like I could heat up I could do like a grilled romaine.
Exactly. There
I
you
could
go.
Do that. I could try that.
So, and what would the, okay.
Okay, and then I would put, okay, it's summertime. Well, it's not summer, but it's summer in LA because it's 90 degrees. But I would do a grilled romaine and then I would Well, and then I would put maybe some.
So that's the heat. So tell me what the heat. So what did you learn from heat? The heat section that would influence how you grilled the romaine.
Well, I would,
or at least can you articulate what would happen in that grilling?
Well, I would make sure that my heat sources got hot, but then I would not want to put it directly on the heat because it's a gentle lettuce. Mm-hmm. But I would want it to get a little grilled up. So I would make sure that it was on a warm, like a toasty part, but not directly over the heat.
Mm-hmm.
And I would move it around a lot to make sure that it was like cooking right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would do. How am I doing?
Great. You're great. Yeah.
Then I would take it off. Then I would have, well, for me, I don't like a lot of vegetables. So what vegetables would I want to put on there? I would want to put I think it would need a creamy dressing.
Right.
Because I think it would need some good fat to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do something like I won't do a Caesar, but something like that, a creamy, like kind of garlicky, rich taste there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it definitely needs something crunchy. So maybe like some bacon, and that's mm-hmm. another source of fat and salt.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be good. And then it needs probably another vegetable. So even though I don't really like tomatoes, I know other people mm-hmm. like them and they're kind of acidic. So I'll put those little cherry tomatoes, cut them in half.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I'll give. And then I would put some lemon probably at the end or in the dressing, depending mm-hmm. on what kind of dressing I made, and salt and pepper.
Okay.
How'd I do?
I think you're doing great. You're doing great. I want to ask you a question because she does talk about the bacon in the heat section.
Okay.
And
I would kick the bacon in the oven.
And why would you do that?
Because I think bacon cooked in the oven tastes better mm-hmm. and it's more evenly cooked
mm-hmm.
and I can monitor it better.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how I like to cook bacon.
Right.
But I would put it in there probably at like 350-ish
mm-hmm.
and then I would watch it because that's what she tells you to do.
Yes, yes, yes.
And probably turn the pan. Sounds like
And what you're doing is you're, and do you remember the word for?
I'm rendering.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm rendering. I know I'm rendering. I'm so proud of myself. And then I would cut up the bacon really, really small. Mm-hmm. So it's like crunchy bits. And she talks about these like little crumb bits in mm-hmm. her thing. And I probably would sprinkle some of those mm-hmm. on top too.
Right.
Cause
right.
I like a crunch.
And I think, yeah. So you've done a lot. You've built it. I mean, so clearly you actually know, and I think a lot of cooks know more than what they realize.
Yeah.
And I think that's, but to be able to codify it is what she allows you to do. And that then liberates you. And I think that, I think she allows you to then, I think that this would allow you to do what I do a lot of, which is read a menu or read a dish at a restaurant or do a description mm-hmm. of a dish at a restaurant and begin to imagine what it would taste like because you understand these components and that there are like, you will see that like so many dishes at restaurants have been sort of formulaically structured to satisfy in all of these ways, right? It's not just like, oh, these chefs know how to combine things. It's just these crazy ways that I don't understand. It's like, no, you understand it. You do it all the
time.
Right,
you do it all the
time. You do it all the time. Like your salad that you just made up has everything that most great dishes at every restaurant have, which is like, you know, some layer of creamy unctuousness, some aggressive salting in the bacon, textural contrast from the romaine that you've already made more interesting than just straight romaine because it's going to be charred in spots and softer in spots. So you're already like building complexity, and more complexity is more interesting and it's more sensory information, and more sensory information where everything is sort of in counterpoint or harmony mm-hmm. is more delicious because we like our tongues and mouths and eyes like a lot as long as it all adds up, right?
I want to change something on my salad.
What?
I want to take the tomatoes out because I don't like tomatoes. And I kind of feel like maybe I want some sort of a fruit element, something like kind of sweet.
Yeah.
And like something like apple or pear or something.
It's funny that you're taking the tomato out because the tomato is a sweet thing and it is a fruit.
I hate tomatoes,
right?
Though.
So yeah, but you're right. So you're taking the populist,
I just want to eat my salad,
sweet tart thing, and you want to replace it with another sweet tart.
Yeah.
Thing. So I like your think your apple.
And
your apple would be great with the bacon.
And it probably needs a little red onion.
Yep.
She would say you have to put the red onion. She would. What did she call that? Where you like put it in an acid to suck out some of the she has a word for it.
Term. I'm blanking.
Anyways.
Acidulation? No.
No. It's not macerate, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can find it. But I would do that.
Okay.
And I would make them like thin slices, not like little squares, just because I think that that would be more fun for me.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. It'll look better too.
I think my salad sounds really good.
I think it sounds fantastic.
I feel like I probably already had that salad before somewhere else. Okay. So let me ask you now. Mm-hmm. You come to my restaurant, you eat my salad. How do you approach writing about food and flavors? Like, how much of salt, fat, acid, and heat are things that you're thinking about when you're mm-hmm. writing about food?
Yeah. Well, I think this is because her book is so about the underpinnings and sort of the behind the scenes and the principles between behind arriving at something. I think that, like, yeah, when I'm tasting something, like for example, I went to a brand new restaurant in Santa Monica called Onda, O-N-D-A, and it's the new restaurant from Gabby Kamara from Contramar in Mexico City and Kala in San Francisco and Jessica Koslow from Squirrel in Silver Lake.
Okay.
And there are these two super talented chefs who just opened this restaurant together and at the proper hotel. And so it's like, you know, very exciting for a food person to professional food editor, writer to go taste for the first time these creations from like two of my favorite chefs.
Right.
And whose restaurants are both individually amazing. And so there's just this curiosity. And so it's, you know, it's like, so I mean, so much of what writing is like, as you know, is kind of context and setting the scene. And so I've stepped into their narrative already.
Mm-hmm.
I've stepped into their room. I've stepped into their narrative. I start reading the menu, and the menus are literature. They can be, and they are,
right.
Whether it's good or bad literature,
right.
You know? And, and so, I'm going to answer your question, but I think since this is a podcast about reading, you mm-hmm. know, cause books, you know, it's as much about reading and even outside of the book. Right.
Right.
And so there was a menu item, called Fish Hiding in Kelp.
Mm.
And so I'm like, all right, that's
provocative.
That's provocative.
Yeah.
And that's like, okay, what is this? And then it's seaweed. It's basically like an Italian, like it reminds me of an Italian fritto misto. Right?
Okay.
And so, but it's.
Which is like mixed fried fish things.
Yes. Yes. So it's kelp.
You okay.
Know? So seaweed. Seaweed that's been chopped up. And then fresh anchovies.
Okay.
And then slices of lemon.
Okay.
So we're talking about salt, fat, acid, and heat,
yes.
Right? And this dish embodies all of those principles, and in a very elemental way. So, and then it comes with a little dip that looks like green goddess dressing. I can't even remember what the dip is, but it's a nice acidic and
okay.
creamy fat
okay.
counterpoint to these crisp fried, fine masa battered kelp. Anchovies and thinly sliced lemons. And it's salty, it's crunchy, it's been applied to this high fat oil that is. And so this is what I know. I'm eating this thing and it is incredible. And I know why it's incredible, because I know these principles.
Right.
And I know that the oil was most likely 350 degrees, because that is the near perfect temperature that she gets into to some degree. I can't remember if it's 350 is what she says, but that. Where things can be deep fried and the inside gets cooked at the right speed, and the outside becomes crisp, and the water comes out and of the ingredient, and so, and then you have this, you know, salty, you know, this salty kelp to which heat has been applied to a batter that crisps up the batter that is also crisped on the highly acidic lemon, right? And she gets into acidity,
right.
And what lemon acidity is, and how that works and what that does to your palate. And then the anchovies are the fattiest component, because
right.
they're this very fatty fish that is also inherently salty.
Salty.
And so it's a pretty salty dish. I have to say, like, they're going to dial back the salt, because they at the end they add salt too.
Right.
And so they don't need to add as much salt. But
right.
it was still delicious and crunchy. And so I think about what she talks about when I think about this dish, and I know that they thought about these things and they considered the balance of acid. And to put without the lemons, that wouldn't be a complete dish.
Right.
And that is the crucial acidic component that so many chefs and so many home cooks don't comprehend to a degree. And it's what I've learned of anything, and it's I can think of many cookbooks, many chefs I've talked to, many stories I've written, where like in which the message is repeated and clear. Home cooks don't use enough fat, salt, or acid.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like they don't use the heat the right way. So it's like
we're doing it wrong.
We're doing it wrong, right? And so it's like, you know, more fat, more acid, more salt. And like and just play with those things and play with the heat level. And those are how you get all the magic. So
I think people are scared of salt and fat. Mm-hmm. Like that it's not healthy and you're gonna have a heart attack or something.
Yeah.
Like I think that that's where that comes from.
Yes.
And I don't think people understand acid and heat.
Yes.
I think people know, like, if you put a ton of butter on something, it's probably going to taste better. Mm-hmm. But people are like, oh, we can't have butter. We have to have, I can't believe it's not butter, which, no.
Yeah.
You don't have to do that.
Yeah. No.
Don't do that.
Yeah. And I think that, like, I think people don't realize, like, you want, like, things to taste dynamic.
Right.
And, like, acid is super dynamic and like, borders on aggressive. Right. Salt can, too. And fat too. It's like kind of play with a heavy hand with those things in the right way at the right moment. And often toward like at the beginning, the salting at the beginning is such a crucial thing that she really gets into.
She drives that home hard.
Yeah. And that's like, and that is one of the most important things you can do. And so like, I love that she starts with that. Right.
Yeah.
So I guess I think about these things and I practice these things all the time. And she really came up with the short list that like...
Right. Because she says in the book, when she took this idea to one of the chefs or cooks at Chez Panisse, they were like, yeah, duh. And she's like, right, but it's not actually written down anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so then she spent 15, 17 years learning how to cook for real and kind of making, I'm assuming, her own mental list of salt, fat, acid, heat, and how it all works. Then she wrote it down. And so it's something that we all probably inherently know when we taste a food, like, oh, this tastes right.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily understand what is making it right or how those things work together.
Yes.
So she wrote it down and she said, this is what your taste buds already know.
Right. Oh, and here's the thing. This is going to sound deeply pretentious, much like the idea that like she's learning all these lessons at Chez Panisse, which is actually a fantastic place beyond the top level pretension alert that one might get triggered to or by. This is going to sound really pretentious, but like, it is, we do know, are right. You're right. You just don't know what to do with that knowledge necessarily.
Right.
And like, this is this example. I was working on a story and for Condé Nast Traveler, and I was in Burgundy cooking with, or helping, writing a story about Ludo Lefebvre, returning to his home region of France. And so I was in a kitchen with him cooking for some winemakers in the south of France and not south France, Burgundy. And so, but we were like, it was me and a couple of his colleagues, who are not chefs, you know, one was a wine person. One's like, they're both wine people, GMs, you know, we all know how to cook, but we're not chefs and we don't work in the kitchen. And, but we were helping Ludo cause we had to prep and there's a sauce. Or it was like a kind of a cream wine sauce for some chicken. And he's making it, but you know, we're helping him chop stuff. We're helping him saute things. And then, so the sauce is coming together at the end and he thinks it's done, but he's like, okay, like everyone taste it. And he's like, hands out spoons. And he's like, you know, he's like, taste it. He's like, what do you think? What do you think? And they're like, he literally wanted to know what three people who weren't him, who weren't professional cooks, what does it need more of? He's like, what does it need more of? Is there enough acid? Is there enough salt? And people are like, more acid. And then it's like, he's like, okay, try it again. And we're like, it's like, it's really good. And he's like, he's like, maybe like a little more acid. And they're like, okay. And we tried, and we're like, oh my God, then it's done. But it was only done until three non-chefs had all agreed that it was as delicious as it could be. Mm. And he trusted us and to some degree, like, you know, needed our, he didn't need us, but we made it better because we knew what was good. And he was like, and he understands that even though he's the guy who knows everything and can make things delicious, that that what other people think, just common non-chefs think, they have wisdom that's important. I think we all have something that is like a chef, even if we don't have all the chef knowledge.
Right.
And then Samin gives you a lot of that knowledge so that you can be, you can feel more confident and you can actually affect how things taste. And then your opinion and your experience of things, you know how you can then modify things off of what your taste and experience is.
Right. Well, this is kind of reminds me of what we were talking about last week when we were talking about, you know, the political act of feeding yourself or feeding others and reading a recipe and whatever. And it's also now becoming more clear to me that it has a lot of, I mean, I know that eating with other people is communal, but this idea that there's a communal palate or some sort of, that we're all contributing to the work of other people's food. And if you serve something at a dinner party and you get certain feedback, then the next time you serve it, you're going to adjust, and that it's super collaborative. And that's in just the tasting part of it. But in watching her show, just the episode that I watched, the fat episode, where she goes all over, you know, this region of Tuscany and gets all these different ingredients and makes all this stuff, you see, you know, the prosciutto comes from a butcher, and that's part of the collaboration. And the bread is with the focacciaria guy, and that's part of the collaboration. Mm-hmm. And that as we're making this food, it's not just about, you know, our ingredients that we bought at the store or the farmer's market, but it's also about where those things came from and how those people's philosophy on salt, fat, acid, and heat, right? Mm-hmm. Like that it's all, you could take this much more directly to the source.
Yeah.
If you wanted to go that way with your thinking.
Right, right.
But that those, like the person who makes the salami is also thinking about salt and fat and acid and heat.
Yeah.
As they're making their part of your meal.
Right, right. Absolutely. And that they're, and that in return, like if cooking, as we talked about last week, is the most intimate narrative in some ways. If a recipe and the knowledge, if a recipe is someone's personal interpretation and sort of codification and algorithm of how to then share something that they created with, to then unlock it for others in the future. What people then do with that is again taking in a very personal and intimate a creation, and then embodying it, and in some ways then sharing it with themselves and the diners that they share the table with, and that those diners in return, in sharing knowledge, could then modify that story, that narrative, that algorithm. And then if that algorithm can be changed, and then you as the author of that recipe have taken in the community that you've served.
So, yeah, it's like a feedback loop.
Yes, yes.
Two things for us to get out of here. One, and I have to say this as someone who loves milk.
Mm-hmm.
And as a huge, I like to joke that I'm part of the milk lobby because I love milk, whole milk. There is a part where she talks about being at Chez Panisse and asking for a glass of milk.
That's right.
And I, reading this in bed, I turn to my husband and I go, well, this is the greatest book that's ever been written because she ordered milk at Chez Panisse. And we're from the Bay Area, so that restaurant has always like kind of loomed over, you know, our heads.
Right.
But I loved that because that is her.
Uh-huh.
Like how she's so unpretentious in such a pretentious space.
But I think that like in the end, but they brought it to her, right?
They sure did.
Yeah, well, the thing is, but I think that her request was the most logical request in the world.
Of course, she's having chocolate souffle.
And I thought that like, I think that it's like, because the funny thing is that eventually people started serving cookies and milk as a dessert.
And milk at our wedding.
Yeah. And because I think it just makes complete and total sense. And I remember her, I think it's fantastic. And I do think that they probably really appreciated that.
Right.
And I think, isn't that the night? That's not the same night that she asked for a job, was
she
it?
She went back and brought a letter saying how meaningful it was and like begged for a job. And the person who she brought the letter to ended up being the manager who was the person who showed her the souffle and brought her the milk.
Well, and the thing is, I think what she went, and because of that, she actually proved that she understood food and how things taste and how good things, and she also showed a passion. It's funny because that reminds me of a time that my wife and I talk about all the time when we were in New York, and we were at a great restaurant on the Lower East Side in the late 90s, and it was, it had been, you know, given however many stars the New York Times was giving at the time. And it got the max, you know, the very best review. And,
it was
supposedly one of the best restaurants as, you know, the early, the 90s sort of restaurant, golden era of the downtown restaurant or the beginning of it. And at the end of this meal, my friend Jake, it was the end of the meal. It was the end of the night. There were hardly any diners in it. You know, we'd had some wine. But the food was so good, and it was the dessert, and we were finishing up, and there was some sauce on the plate, and my friend Jake was like, I just want to, like, lick this plate. He's like, I just want to lick this plate. He's literally holding it, and the chef's walking through the dining room, and he hears him, and he's like, go for it. And he just, like, he's like, oh, thanks, and he just licks the plate, and the chef was so happy. But it was the most, it was the rudest thing you could do. It was the most gauche, you know, offensive, selfish, but also unbridled, you know, passionate act that this guy could do. And the chef was like so happy that he made food that could lead to someone to licking the plate, which you would not do in a 4-star restaurant typically. But it was the moment, and as a result, that was probably the, you know, probably one of the highlights of that chef's evening. So, and you know. And like it's that's what she clearly, like, it's that we all have this passion that she has. And I think that's what's like, and I love that she didn't feel intimidated to not to the degree that she wouldn't ask for the milk. So I think we should always ask for the milk.
I literally ask for the milk often. Okay. The last thing we talk about always is the cover and the title. What do you think of both of these things?
I think the title, I think, is fantastic. I mean, I think it's elemental, you know, and I think it's just, I do like, it's just, I love that it's a series of words, and I know these are all things that I love, and I know, like, I didn't need to be told this because I have worked with these principles for so long, but I love that someone has finally done it so in such but I think in a way the cover, the hand, you know, the illustration, which is basically a shelf of things that are very familiar to us, but that really when you break it down, it's just this lovely sort of naive drawing of all of these things, canned tomatoes, olive oil, various vinegars, you know, a bundle or a couple of sort of bundles of herbs and chilies and salty anchovies and the rich olive oil, all the components, and that it's handwritten, that the whole thing is hand drawn. So it's basically that it's not a font. I think it all conveys what is inside.
I agree with you fully. I think it's beautiful. I also think this is the end papers. It's the pantry essentials and the kitchen essentials, and it's black and white drawing. And I think those are also just fantastic. I think that the title is so smart and clean and just, there's no junk. There's no extra. And I think Wendy McNaughton's illustrations are phenomenal.
Oh yeah.
I think they're just so beautiful. I just think this book is so beautiful. For those of you who have not actually read this book or looked at this book, go find this book. If you're not sure you want to commit to it, check it out of your library. Take a look at it. I highly recommend it. If you're interested in food, even if you think you know all the things to know about being a home chef, or if you think I'm terrified of cooking and I don't want to cook anything and I really love takeout, I still encourage you to check out this book, which is very rare for me. Normally, I don't really harass you guys about certain books, but I just found this to be so valuable that I think there's something for everyone in this book to just play with.
Mm-hmm.
I would say. Hugh, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we will see you guys in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening to today's episode. And of course, a huge thank you to our guest, Hugh Garvey. Find everything we discussed in today's episode in the link in the show notes. Get your book recommendation read on air by sending an email to askingthestacks@gmail.com. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade, New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker, London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune in to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Each week, we bring you stock market outlooks, macroeconomic updates, and investment strategies that can help you succeed. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience about how they navigate uncertain markets. Prepare to be engaged, enlightened, and entertained by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.